The Book Nook on WYSO is presented by the Greene County Public Library with additional support from Clark County Public Library, Dayton Metro Library, Washington Centerville Public Library, and Wright Memorial Public Library.
Good morning. Welcome to the Best of the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis. 1 week ago, last Sunday, the notable historian David McCullough died, a man who did more in the last 50 years to popularize American history than just about anybody else. I did two interviews with David, one in 2002 for his biography of John Adams, and then again in 2015, we talked about the Wright brothers. Let's remember David McCullough as we go back into our archive and listen to that interview on the Best of the Book Nook. The invention of powered flight has to be the great invention of the 20th century. Do you agree?
Wholeheartedly, I agree. And it wasn't just that they invented the airplane, as most everybody knows, but the active verb there is, noun there is flight. They learned how to fly. And so many of the other aviation pioneers were theoretical. Octave Chanute, the great American bridge engineer who got very interested in gliders, and Samuel Langley, who created his aerodrome, as he called it, a giant machine that looks sort of like an immense grasshopper or something, was launched off of the top of a houseboat down the river from Washington on the Potomac. And in both times, both cases, just plunged right into the water. Neither he nor Chanute ever actually went up in a plane, never risked being a test pilot, as it were. And that is a huge difference in the success of Chanute and Langley, I think, and the success of the Wright brothers. Wilbur had a wonderful analogy. He said, a wild horse, you can tame a wild horse by sitting on a fence and watching it and keeping notes and then retiring to a comfortable chair and writing a thesis on your theory of how to break a wild horse. Or, he said, you can get on the horse and ride it. And that was their way of doing it. They had to learn how to ride with the wind and how to create a machine that they could control sufficiently in order to ride with the wind.
David McCullough is my guest today. His latest book is The Wright Brothers. These Wright brothers, Wilbur and Orville, were hardworking, industrious, highly intelligent problem solvers. You do a superb job of revealing to your readers who the Wrights were and how they went about doing the things which ultimately changed the very course of human history.
Yes, they loved their work. They worked hard at the bicycle shop. It's the only income they had. And all they could spend on their experimental activities came from their profits, their rather modest profits from the bicycle shop. They had no university supporting them, no foundation. They had no political contacts. They had no wealthy backer. They had no experience working on technical projects other than their own. They had no training of that kind. They had no college education. They didn't even finish high school. But that didn't hold them back. I think it's essential to understand also that they were brilliant. Orville was a very clever and inventive had a mechanical creativity that was notable. But Wilbur was a genius. I don't think there's any question about that. And Wilbur was the leader. Wilbur was the older brother, the big brother, the boss. And Orville was happy to have it that way. But certainly the two heads were better than one, even the miraculous one that Wilbur carried around. And I would also include their sister Catherine, who was, in her way, I think, as essential as any of the essential ingredients to how the story turned out. And I feel strongly that I know that one of the reasons I wanted to write the book was to give her credit long overdue.
This is very much a family story, particularly these four central family members, their father, their sister, and then the two brothers who were almost inseparable. It seems like when they weren't together, that this was difficult, particularly for Orville.
It was always difficult, and they did everything together. They worked together every day. They ate all their meals together. They even had a joint bank account. They would sometimes spontaneously break out either humming or whistling the same tune. But they were also very different. They were unidentical twins, if you will. Wilbur was, as I said, the much more cerebral of the two, and his mind was taken up with lofty thoughts all the time. Orville was very shy, and he had what in the family were called his peculiar spells, where he would get sort of moody and touchy, and usually happened when things weren't going right or he was overtired. Or if he was criticized, he couldn't take that. He refused to do any public speaking at all. He left that all to his brother. But both of them had been urged and trained by their father to use the English language both correctly and effectively. And so they were superb writers. They wrote wonderful letters, wonderful accounts of this adventure or that. And Wilbur was also, as it turned out, though he didn't crave to be a public speaker or to command the speaker's rostrum, when he did speak, he was extremely effective, often very moving.
What was it about Dayton, Ohio, that made this the perfect place for the Wright brothers to be inventing things?
Well, Wilbur was once asked what was the secret to success, and he said, pick out a good mother and father and grow up in Ohio. And there was a lot of truth in that, because he did have a splendid mother and father, and being in Dayton at that time was to be in a hotbed of innovation. All kinds of things were being manufactured, invented, created, all through the city. More patents were issued to people in Dayton on a per capita basis, more patents to Dayton than any other city in the country. And it was all around them, at news breaking every day. And, of course, it was an era when invention was not only prevalent, but it was taken to heart in a patriotic way because it was American invention. The light bulb, the telephone, the elevator, the mousetrap, all invented during that period. The cash register, of course, being among the more important inventions, and its manufacture being dominated, led by the firm in Dayton.
As I read your account of the Wright brothers, I kept thinking, as the two of them were at Kitty Hawk and they had these first flights, these first powered flights that worked, I kept being reminded of Buzz Aldrin and Neil Armstrong being those first two men on the surface of the moon, and how no one had ever done this before. And even though the technology now seems primitive, it was cutting edge at the time. And I had Buzz Aldrin on the program a couple times, and I was able to ask him what it felt like to stand on the moon. And I've always wondered what it would have been like to ask one of the Wright brothers what it felt like that first time, or those first times that they actually were airborne in that machine. What an amazing feeling of exhilaration that must have been.
Well, they asked Orville, who flew the very first flight, if he was scared. And he said there wasn't time to be scared. The first flight only lasted 20 seconds and only covered 120 feet. It was nothing, but it was real. And before the day was over, Wilbur was flying well over 500 feet. I think it's fascinating, too, that the first human being to fly, Orville Wright, and the first human being to set foot on the moon, Neil Armstrong, both came from that same southwestern corner of Ohio.
True.
And that you could dismiss it by saying it's just coincidental. I'm not sure about that.
Hmm.
I really think there was something in the spirit, the air, the tempo of that time of growing up in Ohio in relatively speaking, as history goes, a very relatively short time, and having the inspiration that the success of the Wright brothers had as part of the atmosphere of Ohio. And I think Armstrong said as much himself.
After the Wright brothers had some success and figured out how to fly, they had to do a lot of practicing. They had to do a lot of working and innovating. And they did much of this just a few miles down the road from where our studio is at a place called Huffman Prairie. And wow, what a thing that must have been. At first, people didn't pay much attention, did they?
No, it's hard for us to understand. Many people thought they were crackpots. They were eccentric, nice fellows, but a bit strange. And that, of course, man can't fly. And, of course, they're wasting their time. And, of course, we'll just have to be kind to them when they fail over and over again. The newspapers in Dayton wouldn't even send reporters out to take a look. And one of the editors later on was asked, how could that have been? And he said, well, I guess we were just plain stupid. And as was the country, as was our federal government. The Wrights appealed to them four times that they wanted to show them what they could do with their plane. It would come to Washington with it, or somebody would be welcome to come out to Dayton and go out to Huffman Prairie and see for themselves. Wouldn't do it because they thought they were crackpots. It wasn't until, of all people, a beekeeper from Ohio, Amos Root, who published a beekeeper's newspaper, who came down on his own initiative because he'd heard about the Wright brothers and wrote an extensive and, importantly, totally accurate account of their flying that first appeared in print anywhere. And when Mr. Root offered a copy of his article to Scientific American to publish in their magazine at no charge, they just totally ignored it. I think Mr. Root is one of my favorite characters that I've ever had the privilege to write about. He was a wonderful man with immense curiosity and who went about things in such an orderly but spirited fashion and made his mark in history in his own way.
He was a beekeeper from Medina, Ohio. We've been joined by David McCullough. His new book is The Wright Brothers. And you give us a lot in this book about what I like to call their barnstorming days. They had jump-started this non-existent aviation industry, and
right,
these two gentlemen really knew how to fly. And so at several points in the book, we have one of them, Orville in the U.S. flying and demonstrating the planes, and then you have this long period of time, I think it was 6 months long, where Wilbur is just fascinating the people in France.
Oh, he has them they're almost hypnotized. He was the sensation of Europe. Most people think, well, the Wright brothers flew at Kitty Hawk in 1903, and that was the birth of the airplane, and everybody started to fly. Nobody even believed that they were flying. until 1908, a good 5 years later. And it happened because Wilbur went to France, because the French were interested in seeing what the brothers could do, whereas nobody here in official America was interested. And as much as they wanted to demonstrate here, they were devout patriots, they got tired of having the door slammed in their face. And so Wilbur went over and flew at Le Mans, the great racetrack city southeast of Paris. And he flew to a good-sized crowd the first time. And then the second time, the crowd was three times as big. And ultimately, the crowds numbered in the many thousands. And they kept coming from everywhere, from all over Europe, to see this phenomenon. And Wilbur became the most popular American in France since Benjamin Franklin. He spoke no French. He was very taciturn much of the time, went about his business, concentrating all that he had on every little last detail to make sure everything was happening as he wished. And the French loved him for that. The more he acted like an American from Ohio, the more they loved him. And his courage was never lost sight of, because each and every time that either brother went up on a test flight, he stood a pretty good chance of getting killed, and he knew it. For that reason, as I'm sure you know, the brothers never flew together, because if one were to be killed, there would still be another one that could carry on with their mission. Orville Ray was very nearly killed. He had a bad crash at Fort Myer just across the Potomac River in Virginia, across the river from Washington. And he had a young Army lieutenant with him. He was flying at the Army base there. And his name was Selfridge, and he was killed. He was the first fatality in the history of aviation. And Orville was very severely injured, but he was also very severely set back in his outlook on life. We would call it depression. And there was good deal of concern, first of all, whether he'd live, then whether he'd ever walk again, let alone fly again. But his sister, Catherine, on hearing that this crash had taken place, was almost immediately packed and on a train to Washington. And she was with him in the hospital, staying in the hospital for a month and more, or more. And she really brought him through it, and particularly in terms of his mental outlook. She was there, as I said, when needed, and she was really needed at that moment. Wilbur's still over in France. Wilbur was in France over a year, and that's generally forgotten. And the longer he stayed, the more popular he became. He was a hero for the whole world, instantly. Once he put on his demonstrations at Le Mans and later at Pau, farther south in France, down near the Spanish border. I think one of the strongest elements in their story is the importance of how they were brought up. They were brought up to be gentlemen, to have good manners, to be modest, to dress properly, to never get the ill will of other people, if it can be avoided, to speak ill of other people. They didn't do that. Their father was an itinerant minister, and he preached to them about behavior all through their childhood. And I include Catherine in that, too. She was exceptional in that way. We have to remember they grew up in a house that had no running water, no indoor plumbing, no electricity, no telephone, but it had a plenitude of books. And they read. They were told to read. They all read all the time, and they read everything. History, natural history, fiction, literature, poetry, books on architecture, art, birds, you name it. And and they were taught, their father insisted that they learn to use the English language both correctly and effectively, and they did. And to read their letters in this day and age when so many young people don't write very well, and I'm not just talking about handwriting, I'm talking about the use of the language, to read their letters is humbling, because here they are, they never finished high school, and yet their vocabulary, the range of their interests, their correct sentence structure and all the rest were of the highest order, and made a big difference in the ultimate success with their work.
I think one thing that really struck me in your account of the Wright brothers, David, is the fact that I've read a lot of books about the Wright brothers, but I never realized how important Charlie Taylor was.
Well, I agree with you completely. He was very important and a wonderfully, refreshingly different kind of character. The brothers never swore. They never smoked. They were good boys, as it were. Charlie was different. And Catherine couldn't stand him because she didn't like the idea that this fellow that worked for them often thought he knew more than they did. Well, he often did know more than they did. And the brothers knew how valuable he was, so they would never get rid of him, which is what she wanted. One of the few times where they went against their sister's wishes. Charlie Taylor was a great character, and John T. Daniel down at Kitty Hawk's, wonderful character. I like him a lot.
Mm.
And and some of the doctors were, I thought, good people. Like Huffman, the man Huffman Prairie was named for. He thought they were crackpots, fools, but he came around. And he was a banker, and he was important, and that was not no small conversion. As you know, Huffman Prairie has been preserved exactly as it was. It's part of the Wright-Patterson base. And it's a great thrill to go out there and think that this is where the practical airplane was born. And think what a change the world has been through as a consequence. There was a piece in the Wall Street Journal just yesterday, I think it was, that this summer, between June 1 and August 31, is estimated that 222 million people will fly on American airplanes.
Mm.
That's commercial airliners. And something like 31 million of them will be going overseas in just 3 months. We take it all for granted.
Amazing.
We fly at 35, 40,000 feet, take it for granted. Well, how did it happen? Who made it happen? When did it happen? And what obstacles, what insoluble problems had to be dealt with in order for it to happen? But I would have wanted to have written that book, this story, even if they had failed at their objective. So much is there about the human spirit and about devoting yourself to a high purpose. I think there's a great deal of important lessons to be learned from the story of the Wright brothers.
Now, this book is a lovely tribute to their accomplishments and to them as individuals. David McCullough has joined us on the program. His book is The Wright Brothers. And since that first book about the Johnstown flood, you have accomplished so much. You have done so much. Your scholarly work has just been phenomenal. And about 20 years ago, I had someone on the program who I think you might have known during your Yale days, the New Yorker writer Brendan Gill. And when I was introducing him, he came out to the studio. I went over his list of many accomplishments, and when I was finished saying it, Brendan, if you recall him, he had such a wit. He said, "It sounds like you just read my obituary." And at that point, I just thought, well, I didn't mean it that way. But it makes me want to ask you, David, with this wonderful body of work, I think of you as America's historian. How would you like to be remembered?
I would like to be remembered as someone who helped our country know more and appreciate more about our country's story and how much we, as who have the privilege of being Americans, owe to those who went before us, and to not forget them and not proceed through life without the inspiration that can be drawn from their examples. I think that history is very important to understanding how our government works, our system of representation works, and thus make us more attentive and participating individuals as citizens. But it's also an enlargement of the experience of being alive, because we shouldn't limit what we know about life on Earth to our own relatively brief biological time, when the whole reach and realm of those who have gone before us and their time is open to us. It's a source of pleasure, and it's also a wonderful antidote to the hubris of the present, and keep us a little more balanced in how we feel about how important our contributions and accomplishments are. I think that also it's a reminder of the joy to be found in work. We talk so much about ease and luxury and time off and a multitude of possessions, so forth. And then you take a look at the story of someone like the Wright brothers, who weren't in the work for the money, who weren't desirous of long vacations or lolling around a swimming pool. They wanted to get up and get to work every day because they loved their work. And as I said before, they had purpose in their lives. And that's part of the secret to the good life, big part of the secret.
Well, David, it's always a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you, sir, and all the best to you.
That was the historian David McCullough talking about the Wright brothers, his biography that he published 7 years ago. My second and final interview with David, and I was able to ask him about how he wished to be remembered. David died 1 week ago. He was 89 years old. And that majestic voice was showing some age there on that recording. But what a wonderful historian he was, and just a wonderful writer. And he will be missed. He wrote 10 magnificent books. And The Wright Brothers was another bestseller. You've been listening to the Best of the Book Nook on WYSO, remembering David McCullough.